Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, Campus Radio audience. Welcome to this session of the seminar series, Work in Progress in the Social Studies. We are meeting tonight, radio audience, in Valletta at Darul-Uloma, and we're very grateful to the European Parliament Office, and especially to Massimo Ferrugia, for providing us with this beautiful room. Tonight, our speaker is Mr. Andrew Alamango, a musicologist, researcher, and musician. Andrew Alamango has worked in the field of traditional music research for the past decade. The Etnica project, which many of you remember, was in fact initiated by Andrew in 2001 with the intention of researching traditional melodies and musical instruments and raising awareness of this material with the general public, which I'm sure it did. He has recently launched the Lost Voices Project, about which we're going to hear tonight, in conjunction with the National Archives and the Ministry of Education. His work is focused on the idea of sound preservation and public access to this music for the sake of posterity. Andrew's paper tonight is entitled Malta's Lost Voices, the recording of Maltese music in the interwar period, with a special reference to 1931-32, and I think he has some very interesting words and clips of music to discuss tonight. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. The research paper I'm presenting is about the recording of Maltese music in the brief period between 1931 and 32. This research has resulted in the creation of a database for the National Archives, the launch of the Lost Voices Project, a publication, and a series of audio releases under the FILFMA Records label. The research was conducted and carried out through the National Library here in Valletta, the British Library in London, the EMI Archive Trust Fund, Abbey Road Studios, private collectors, discographers, locally and internationally. Also the friends and families of all those musicians who are protagonists of this story. So, the story of sound recording and reproduction began in 1877, when Thomas Edison invented the phonograph. This machine consisted of a sheet of tinfoil wrapped around a cylindrical drum, which when turned by a handle, rotated and moved laterally. As it moved, it passed under a touching metal stylus, which impressed grooves in the tinfoil. The grooves impressed in the tinfoil caused the stylus to move in and out when played back, and created a diaphragm to vibrate, and recreated or reproduced sound by moving the air or causing the air to vibrate. A year later, in 1878, Emil Berliner was granted a patent on a flat disc gramophone, making production of multiple copies possible and practical. The rapid development of playback machines and gramophones in the late 19th century led to the forming of large conglomerate companies whose activities resulted in recording much of the music from around the world. Very early on in the 20th century, the multinationals, these record companies, realized that there was a market for making and selling records far beyond the confines and tastes of the Western world, and that the diversity in the content recorded would encourage sales both of records and of playing machines. The impetus to make records of vernacular music, which is in the language or dialect of that country or region, was essentially driven by the commercial desire to sell gramophones worldwide. By the first decade of the 1900s, major companies have recorded the ethnic music on all continents. Acoustic methods of recording involved using an acoustic comb, displayed here, which could be sensitive to the sonic waves emitted, thus causing a needle to vibrate and etch signals in wax. This method meant that musicians in a studio would need to be placed in unconventional positioning, as seen in the picture, around the comb, depending on the volume and the timbre of their instrument. From these wax masters, an alloy was poured into the groove to create a negative sounder, which would then press the records. As you can see, what is interesting to note here is that the actual recording equipment is always hidden in the pictures, because it was a way of preventing trade secrets being taken from company to company. Like I said, there was a very vicious competition between companies in those days. So you would only see the comb and the orchestra placed around the comb. By the late 1920s, methods of recording were electric. They changed from acoustic to electric, using the moving coil microphone. This no longer required unconventional setups in the recording space. With the introduction of the moving coil microphone, acoustic methods became obsolete. The establishment of 78.26 revolutions per minute had by this time become industry standard. So you have a record, 10-inch record here, which runs at the speed of 78.26 revolutions. This became the industry standard. This meant that a 10-inch shellac would yield approximately 3 minutes of playing time. From this time on, music that was produced to be recorded on disc was tailored to fit into 3 minutes. Hence the establishment of the 3-minute pop song in later decades, so this was an origin. Recorded music became the attractive new product, which, coupled with an increasing ease of mass producing records and better playback technology, would be sold worldwide. The onset of original recording methods also brought about changes in recording techniques, as well as major reorganization of the companies and their strategy. Using advanced and improved technology, key recording centers were set up around the world with agents established in each country. Generally, these agents consisted of a reputable retailer or a hardware store that would supply and service gramophones, records, and their accessories. These agents were considered more finely tuned to the local scene rather than other companies, and were therefore engaged in the business of recording local artists. The agent was responsible for contracting local musicians and preparing them for travel to the recording studios. 1931 was a significant year for the recording industry. It was the year of an important merger for the recording business, when the major recording companies, which were Columbia and the Gramophone Company with his master's voice record label, decided it was in their interest to come together and operate under one name, Electrical and Musical Industries, EMI, 1931, thus eliminating competition and fragmentation of the world markets. Main recording centers like London, Paris, Barcelona, and Milan were established. In fact, the Maltese, Sicilians, and Sardinians would travel to HMP's Milan studio in Piazzale Cicetto. By this time, locally, it seems that successful electrical method recording techniques, more organized recording strategies, and the release of a series of marketable gramophone models, which were becoming more financially accessible to the public, encouraged the local agents to take on the enterprise of recording Maltese music. The resulting music, captured on the Maltese discs, consists of genuine recordings of local traditional and popular music in the style and language of the day. In those days, musical establishments in Valletta were alive and well. By the late 1920s, Piccolo Bot's music establishment was still very empty, and Antonio D'Amato, this is the inside of his shop in those days, of St. John's Street, he's still in St. John's Street, had established themselves as agents with the major record labels, with a similar deal as agents elsewhere. They sold musical goods and were sole agents and wholesalers for gramophones and records. They also supplied other retail outlets in Valletta, Cospicua, Hamrun, Gozo, Slima, and elsewhere. These are the ads which came off the papers in those days, advertising the sale of musical accessories. The earliest documented activity of recordings of Maltese music makes reference to a certain Fortunato Amin, a Jewish merchant from Tripoli, who settled in Valletta after marrying a Jewish woman of Tunisian origin. Habib organized the first recording trip to Tunisia in February 1931. He was a respected member of the Jewish community residing in Malta and the owner of Galerie Lafayette in number 30 Zachary Street. He is still remembered as an entrepreneurial person and the owner of Lafayette, which still stands to this very day. Actually, there's a cosmetic shop right now in it's called Lisette. This was his Gustavian shop, and he's still remembered in that street. The early recordings by Dr. Habib were published under the Polyphone label, Fabrique en France. They are documented in the regular advertisements which appear in newspapers and the journals Il Mara, Kotra, Il Berma, Dr. Shekek, Sidatier. These were all the journals of the late 20s and early 30s. Listed are the tunes which were recorded in Tunis, pressed in France, and shipped back to the agent. In February 1931, a group of Maltese musicians organized and contracted by Dr. Habib boarded the ship to Tunis to record the first local traditional and lyrical songs on the red label Polyphon series. Among the group were ballad singer Emmanuel Mercia, known as Issemenza, who, along with Giuseppe Schirrer-Bischiudi, executed the local Anna singing for this series of records. Semenza was a paraffin seller and poet from Tarashi. He sang a number of his own poems and ballads, including an entrancing rendition of high-pitched chant, Anafilori, it is known as Anafilori or Gormisa, appropriately named Anya Matia. This rare style of chant has become rare today. Focuses on the musical ability of the singer to embellish the tune in a series of hypnotic ornamentations and dissolving cadences with a very highly strained voice. Semenza also appeared on a couple of 45 RPM issues in the late years and 60s, final singles in the early 60s, as well as a 33 RPM vinyl in the 1970s. Here's a bit of a taste of Semenza.
Yeah.
here these days. This next personality is Giuseppe Schwierek, who is known as the Shudi. You mentioned Shudi today with the folk singers. He's very well known. He was one of the most foremost exponents of unscripted prompt improvised singing. He was a humorous character, as you can see, from Brigitte, and he was best known for his improvised and spontaneous rhyming couplets, scripted prompt. He too embarked on the trip to Tunis to record the, on the Polyphone series, and he later recorded on the French Pathé label in 1932. He claims 15 records, to his name, and he also appears on the Audience series catalog later that year, accompanying a number of female folk singers. There are a number of anecdotes related to Shudi, especially by the people of his village. Many of the people of his village still remember him through the rhymes that he sang about them. So the barber, Shudi's barber in the village, can tell you 5 or 6 of Shudi's rhymes, because he would always spontaneously sing either about customers in the shop or about the barber. So the memory of this person actually is still around in the minds that people remember from him. There's one famous story that Shudi, this was told by his nephew, who is still alive. Shudi would occasionally go up Tinkle's Bay to sing Anna on his cards, and apparently he had a beautiful white horse, which was renowned for its beautiful tail, which he kept covered in a sack at all times, because kids used to pluck their hairs and use them as fishing lines. And apparently, as he said to the town on his cards, it said that his singing used to awaken the cocks of the village and make the chickens restless. So there's always rural stories around fox singers. This is the party series that Shudi recorded on. Others who accompanied the Maltese party to Tunisia were popular entertainers and lyrical singers, Walter Garcia and Antonio Toma Castelletti, who, along with Giuseppe Prato on guitar, provided the accompaniment for the lyrical comic and operatic style songs. Walter Garcia, a baritone singer referred to as Watty, was known for his acting prose and operatic interpretation. Toma Castelletti was known for his regular appearances at the Chalet cinema. Watty and Antonio performed regularly at the Café Premier Valletta with the dance orchestra known as the Hungarians. Here behind me, this is the Hungarians. There's the guy with the white hat, is Toma Castelletti, and the guy next to him with the other white hat is Watty Garcia. They were renowned for the lyrical, romantic, and comic style. They recorded a number of lyrical songs and comic performances on the very first Polyphone records and the Caracas catalog, which came later that year, as well as a series of On the Patti series. Giuseppe Prato left here, who is the grandfather of Paul Jordan Minor, was a capable musician and who played and taught guitar, mandolin, banjo, violin, and double bass. I'm going to play another sample which features Giuseppe Prato, Tony, and Watty in the Polyphone series. This is interesting because it features 3 languages: English, Italian, and Maltese.
Come on, 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 come on March 31st, 1931 states, quote,
There have been some records taken in the vernacular, some of them moving in higher spheres, others proposing to give a faithful representation of Maltese folklore. The idea in itself deserves recommendation, and when we heard that a few Maltese artists had gone abroad to record in the vernacular, we were more than pleased. Now, after the thing is done, we wish it was never attempted, to say the least. We are mentioning the thing because we have heard many and many complaints about it, and because personally we consider that many of the records are a question of taste. Despite this, by 1931 the record mania had caught on. Agent and distributor for his master's voice, Anthony Lamartor, had long since established himself as in a commercial relationship with HMV Gramophone Company in Hayes, Middlesex. They had developed a solid reputation locally as importers of gramophones and their accessories since the late 20s. As well as servicing gramophones, Lamartor was already an established wholesaler and retailer of 78 RPM records with a variety of titles in classical and operatic music. Nino Lamartor now took on the new enterprise of producing records of Maltese music by entering into an agency agreement with the Middlesex Space Company, Gramophone Company. The deal meant that Mr. D'Amato had the responsibility and artistic license for finding and signing on the musicians, rehearsing them, and organizing the recording trip to the Milan branch of his master's voice. All costs of travel, lodging, and musicians' fees were at the expense of Mr. D'Amato, who would eventually be reimbursed for the records once they were pressed and exported back to the agents. D'Amato proceeded to contract the well-known composer and director, Maestro Vincenzo Ciappara, for writing the musical scores. Carlos Emiliano, comic entertainer and owner of the local newspaper Dr. Brombos, was contracted to write the verses and lyrics for the songs. He also engaged the well-known bass singer Dominic Buzzetti, tenor Giuseppe Ciappai, and baritone singers Ruggiero Frazzo and Michele Smith. Emanuele Cigna, with a reputation of being one of the best ballet singers of the day, was contracted for the Arnaut singing. Domenico was a team bass singer, contracted by Nino D'Amato for the first HP recordings, apparently on his trip to Milan to the recording sessions, reputedly brought the first coffee machine to Malta from Milan. He claimed to have served the first cappuccino in Mocha Cafe, which is still in Zachary Street, which he established in 1932 on Zachary Street by that time. This is the visiting party to Milan. After 2 months of writing and rehearsals, the party of five artists, along with Carlos Mariano, traveled to his master's voice studios in Via San Antonio, Milan, via Syracuse. On arrival, they were greeted by an expectant maestro, Carlos Amaino, who was the official musical director of H&B Studios. Sabino had received communication from the mother company in the H&B Studios in Hayes regarding the visiting Maltese musicians and made preparations before their arrival. A letter dated 7th May 1931 from the mother company in Hayes, London, to Maestro Sabino in the H&B Studio in London states, quote, "Further to our letter on May 13th and confirming telephone to Mr. Giulietti, the artists have arranged to arrive in Milan on the 8th of June. As they are in a special journey, we hope the party will prevent the satisfactory recording of the 40 to 50 10-inch titles that are projected. It is necessary to supply the following: piano, first violin, cello, saxophone, contrabass, and two mandolins. In addition to this, the guitar will be played by one of the artists. As four of the artists are employed by the government, the vacation leave cannot exceed a fortnight, so it is important that there are no delays." Unquote. Some things haven't changed, should be. Further correspondence later that month between Hayes and the Milan studio tells us a great deal about how the company at Hayes viewed these recording sessions. Quote, "No payment of any sort is made to the artists. As so far as we're concerned, they are recording on a royalty basis. We wish the recording to be carried out without delays, as time at the disposal of the artist is limited, and we wish to keep expenses at the lowest possible level, as the market is a very limited one. All the files to be recorded by the devotees are to be done in 10-inch waxes. So it's interesting to notice that, as said in the correspondence, these musicians were on a royalty agreement, which means they would be paid once the purpose was sold, per se, which a situation which, though favorable for the musician, was not that common. Record companies would usually prefer paying a one-time fee for musicians, and contracts of this sort are usually made to avoid artists being contracted by other agents or able to record for other agents. Another factor worth noting is that even though the Maltese market was very small and limited, especially in comparison to the hundreds and thousands of titles elsewhere, it was generally good practice to keep the presses of records running rather than to have them idle. Also, the sale of records, despite the size of the market, indirectly helped the sale of gramophones. So between the 8th and the 12th of June 1931, Chief Engineer Edward Fowler recorded the vocal music of the Maltese musicians and produced the first 20 tracks, which would appear with an HM prefix and the signature matrix of the engineer OF. So each record actually has the mark of the engineer who recorded the series of records. This is the recording sheet of the first session. 1931. These were found in the British Library. They happen to have all the recorded sheets of the sessions which were done, not only the Maltese clearly, but everything is still there. The 10-inch Asian series filled the white label with gold lettering and a splendid Mogret Maltese cross superimposed below the famous HMP logo of Nip and the Dog and the Gramophone Horn. HM1, the first in the series, featured the ballad track L'Historia di Mario Arturo Maria. It was executed by folk singer Emanuel Chilia Tazabet from Hazagulj. He had the reputation of being the best Ama singer on the island. Chilia's ballads and songs would also establish him amongst the first Ama singers to be recorded, with the sound of the air of Chilia's voice. Foxtrots and Mirabu songs, as well as a number of comical stories and anecdotes, musically accompanied by the studio ensemble. One of the most clearly remembered of these Parlanti, as they were called, stories, was Maddalena. The following year, through a similar agreement with Hayes, D'Amato sent a second group of musicians to record in Milan. The sessions were recorded by engineer C.C. Blyton between the 7th and 12th of September 1932, released late that year under the Blue Label HG series and the Green Label Zonophone series. In these second series of recordings, Chile, accompanied by Carmelo Cardona on guitar, works his comical wit and sociopolitical satire in songs like Shana Svipnia Fiorana and Shana San Paolo. They both contain a horror response by the other members of the studio. You'll hear this later on. For reasons that are as yet unknown, this was the last of the visits to the manor between 1931 to 1932. Though the impact and the popularity of these records was outlived the sessions themselves. Beyond these recordings, it appears that no local music was commercially recorded for a good while. This is kind of incredible. It was not before 1964 that D'Amato would submit and re-release 25 of the most popular Asian Mianzhong titles as 7-inch vinyls, securing the legacy of Chica's ballads, Magdalena, and other songs for generations to come. These 45 RPM singles were re-released under in-house label D'Amato Disc 45 HJ series in blue or black plain labels. Why the phenomenon was so short-lived has not as yet been ascertained. However, limitations of the local market and socio-economic factors which characterized the interwar period and post-war era are likely to be related. I now have a little video sample, which I pulled off the internet, 1933, so it's around that time, and an audio sample of various tunes from these records. On the 26th of March 1931, the local newspaper in Berna advertised the arrival of a new list of records, produced and sold by a local establishment, Picarabot Music Establishment of Merchant Street. These advertisements posted a catalogue of records, which was made by the finest of local artists, contribution by 200 people, as stated, who first recorded in Malta and later on, in June 1931, in Tunis. The catalogue features various composers and conductors, solo musicians, comic artists, operatic and lyrical singers, poets, guitar soloists, a mandolin orchestra, as well as a good number of other singers, including women singers. The front cover of the catalogue displays Gerarda's label illustration, Disco Martini. The audio logo of the classical dome named after the St. Frank's Theatre in Paris appears next to Gerarda's illustration. The catalogue clearly aims to present a wide range of artists and genres, making it appealing to various strata of society. That same year, Louis Caracot arranged for the engineers of Deutsche Grammophon label to bring the recording equipment to the Valletta and execute the recording of the titles in the catalog. Due to the lack of proper recording space, it was customary to use makeshift studios. In this case, it is reported that a large hall in Valletta was identified to carry out such a purpose. The soundproofing of the hall, which was an engaging task, consisted of heavy curtains, drapes, and carpets. The hall had to be large enough to seat considerably large numbers of orchestra musicians and a 70-piece choir, as well as many other small units of musicians. The music on the Odeon series attests to the musical activity of the day, with a variety of popular genre comic songs and tales, romantic sentimental and lyrical songs, traditional ballads, improvised chants, as well as some arias and sacred works. These recordings include the only recorded documents of the work of composers such as Karel Diakonov, Carmelo Hodge, and Mario Cirillo. The two Maltese orchestras in this catalogue were organized by Maestro Diakonov and Maestro Bellinzi, Talamaran. He was head of the British Admiral Band. The two directed the Portuguese Orchestra Vila Martiga, while Maestro Cirillo directed the Orchestra Caracol. The musicians in each of these setups were locally renowned and worked with various directors and in a variety of theatres, music halls and venues, including the ill-fated opera house in Valletta. The orchestras provided the musical accompaniment for the majority of the records listed in the catalogue, supporting an array of singers and various genres. Wati Pakia, Signora, Carmela Guida and Antonio Tomacassetti appear on a number of Carmelo Hodge's sentimental and lyrical compositions, including Rivalità Mabba and Carnival. This song actually ties in with what Vicky was saying 3 weeks ago on her subject of Carnival. This is the catalogue. The Odeon catalogue also covers a good number of comic artists. Sorry, I think I skipped the sample. It's not the sample. There it is. This is the Carnival tune. Thank you.
repertoire feature.
These audio recordings reflect the popular dance culture for entertainment, which usually played in the dance halls such as Chalets in Manhattan, Premier Ballet. These include twisted tangos, waltzes, foxtrots, and polkas, which were the predominant styles and are actually mentioned in this song, Carnival. The audio catalog also covers a good number of comic artists and theatrical personages who formed part of the well-known theatrical company known as Compagnia Independenza. Directed by Michelangelo Borch, the company was best known for its adaptations on operas, and the most familiar and popular one being Zezola Flagship, comedy and parody with highly localized slapstick humor accompanied by the orchestra herald. Characteristic of these personalities in Compagnia Independenza is that they were more actors rather than singers, where clear diction, humor, and stage presence overruled the importance of voice quality. Many of these entertaining songs and tunes have a strong and popular appeal and would be regularly heard on the local cable radio, where the fusion went into the interwar period. The final section of the catalogue was reserved for the traditional singers and guitarists, who are among the finest exponents in the tradition. This includes the reappearance of Semenza with his World War I ballad, Riguera Vida. It seems that the catalogue was successful in gathering artists and disseminating their records to retail outlets across the island. The papers advertised the audience series as being available from the typewriter gramophone store in Valletta, J. Bella in cinema, Vincenzo Pace in Cospicua, Giovanni Cassara in Pietà, J. Stivale in Hamburg, and Carmelo Saliba in Vittoria Gozzo. Possibly due to the lucrative nature of these records and the commotion it caused, a year later, 1932, Lewis Carabao organized one more trip to Tunis, this time to record under the Pathé label, a French concert for which Tunisia and Algiers were a home territory. Made in France, the Martin X series appears with a darker label. Little is known about these recordings, as to date, the full catalogue of listings have not been traced. The extent of the series release is therefore determined, though many of the artists on these records also feature on the audio catalogue. The instrumentation is kept to a minimum, as unlike Maltese recordings, the orchestras were not available for travel. They therefore traveled in smaller combos of people. Therefore, most of the material is to the accompaniment of guitar, piano, guitar, and violin. Giuseppe Pichimire, in fact, executes an interesting folk ballad, recounting the voyage by ship to Tunis called the Viaggio a Tunis. It seems that Schutti also traveled to Tunis on a number of occasions. His fame also went beyond the village and the shore of this island, because he was invited on an organized trip to Tunis by Lewis Carabao to sing for the Maltese community. There are also a number of anecdotes relating to the recording sessions that happened in Tunis, where apparently on various occasions Mr. Carabao was embarrassed by the visiting artists. He was embarrassed by the behavior of these musicians. One time, apparently, the musician got into a brawl amongst themselves in the studio, after someone mocked another who was in the company, and they ended up in a fight. On another occasion, they picked a store company from themselves. I don't understand that. That seems to be a Maltese thing, isn't it? In the late 1950s, a selection of these audio records were re-released at 78 RPM on Carabao's own record label, the Sita Marta, supporting the same Gerald administration. They were transferred at Decca Records in England and dubbed off the original 78s, and some were even transferred to single 45s. The concept of recorded and documented sound seems to have had an impact on the musicians, the composers, and the local audiences. It created the impetus to produce for records under contract by the agents, have the works documented, for the artist to have the works documented and achieve a popular status. even though the production of these records was a brief couple of years, they seem to have remained in the memory of some until recently. The music and works of these musicians and composers is now documented and preserved. Due to the nature of the recording industry and its desire to sell records and current forms to various strata of society, a broad variety of artists and styles were recorded, both open and elsewhere. The discography attests to the variety of musical genre and musical activity available at the time. Other genres, in fact, covered by these records are the comic stories or parlanti, and also referred to as macchietti, which were popular medium of storytelling, accompanied by musical background. There's, in fact, you have to understand that the, for example, the storytelling is told at a particular speed, which was slightly unnatural because it had to fit into a limited time of a few minutes. So you do hear abrupt endings or some slight mistakes at the end because it wasn't always easy to do a number of things. Like today, you just delete them. You have to think of the technology. The recordings presented on these early discs of all these music number approximately 160. Up to now, they constitute the earliest documented sounds of the country, and they are invaluable documents of local musical heritage. It appears that in its initial stages, Maltese recorded music was hugely popular. Though the number has not been fully determined, it seems that a substantial number of Maltese records were sold, which in turn sold a good number of mechanical gramophones. The popularity of the music led to its regular airing on radio diffusion in the late 1930s. The stories and songs lived on in public memory for at least a couple of decades, even though no more records were produced after 1932. The music recorded those 2 years was given a boost with the release of a selection of the 78s transferred to 45 RPM in the 60s. The technology used in those 8 years was clearly substantially superior to the predecessor, and it served to preserve the music for a few decades more. The lost voices now have been rediscovered and transferred to the even more durable medium of audiophile. Along with the records, the biographies and of the musicians, the composers, songwriters, and entertainers have been revived. A last note on preservation. The music presented here or inputted into this database is a reference, a musicological and historical reference. There's the transfer from analog to digital. It's been saved audio file and WAV file and MP3. Have been applied to further preserve the music and to make it available for dissemination. The audio files included in the database, all these lost voices, are part of a larger collection which now lies in the National Archives in Rabat. This could pave the way for the setting up of a national sound archive. It could be an example of a prototype project which would eventually lead to the setting up of a national sound archive, an initiative that could make this and other audio archives accessible for research purposes and to the general public. The one note on last note about the sound quality. Well, the sound quality on the CD varies, and this depends mainly on the physical condition of the records, primarily, and the quality of analog to digital transfer, which means the initial signal once you transfer from the disc to digital. The records were cleaned, the stylus was chosen for the right record, and eventually they were passed through a series of cleaning processes or restoration processes, which involves opening up, in some cases, you can open up a WAV file, a millisecond of a WAV file to about that size, and go in and physically redraw the line. So you can see the technology today is quite advanced to be able to go so far, so deep into the signal and clean it. There was a series of denoising and de-clicking, and obviously there are issues in terms of how far and how deep you clean, because you don't want to really the atmosphere is. Also, you realize that there are two aspects. One is the music that lies there, also the ambience of the place in which it was recorded is also impressed into the groove. In some cases where you have poor sound, it reflects the impossibility of cleaning to that extent. One must note that the idea of filter records was set up with the start of this project with the aim of releasing a series of productions of local vintage music. It aims to preserve and make this material accessible to the public, and also directly aims to gather audio sources from private and public collections and eventually release them. Thank you for your time. This has been interesting. Thank you.
Shining of the
records themselves by a certain strata of society is deemed the quality of the music to be poor or a certain class. And that is likely to happen then as it's today. However, what is interesting is that, yes, everything was placed side by side. You had mana, you had local orchestras, and this was done generally to appeal to the audience and make them sellable. So they would select, this is why the agent would have more, would have the job of contracting the most popular singers, composers, the most popular comic storytellers and so on. Because they were more likely to sell records than just anybody who came along. And therefore you have everything of it side by side. You have a catalogue which features even some sacred music by Diacono. Those were actually, there were about 4 or 5 hours you done on 12-inch, because that gave you a yield of 4:20. But there was only about 4 of those movies, whereas all the other records were 10-inch. So whether it was Anna or Foxtrot or Waltz of Hamlet, it was 2 minutes. And some things, I don't know if it was, again, socially acceptable, how socially acceptable Anna was. But there was probably a bigger market than today to release Anna, because it was probably a lot more a part of society. Both globally and in American way, even for that, there was a lot of Anna going on, so it's not like not Anna was necessarily relegated to just villages or rural lifestyle. The central part of the patriarchy was also Anna, but that was a very urban. And along with the urban Anna, you had the dance orchestras, and yes, they needed big orchestras because they didn't have this concept of playing a CD, right? You didn't have it all recorded and documented. You had to have big live orchestras. However, what is really interesting to me is that actually, because you have to consider prior to this, there was no recording. There's no recording and therefore no documenting of a night of live music. So when the possibility to record came along, they either recorded that, it's okay, this is what we have, let's record it, let's cut it, let's edit it for 3 minutes, because most of these times would go on forever, but you have to edit. So yes, the technology affected the performer and his material. But then it also gave him the impetus to create for the record. But at the same time, the quality, I think, is genuine and very vibrant, because it's like the technology came along and was popular. It's like, what have you got? Let's record it. Let's lay it down. So it's very genuine stuff. And then from then on, you know, the recording industry made artists create this, and eventually got to it. It should not maybe have the same genuinity, you know what I mean? But yes, it was, as you can see, it has logos, a lot of bits of everything, because it had, I think the main intention was wide appeal to sell records, to sell microphones. It was always the bottom line.
Go back to the point of the great diversity of types of music that were around. It seems to me like the main point, really, for the whole existence of the, if you can call it the record industry, the Maltese record industry at the time, seemed to be the existence of music in the Maltese language in general. So it really didn't matter whether it was Anna or Foxtrot or Tanya, because Anna's Maltese form of Foxtrot, etc. There are American forms of South American, etc. that come from all over. And it seemed that as time went on, Maltese music became more marginalized into particularly Anna as we know it today. And that's why it's so marginalized. Because pop music in general has taken over. And for pop music now, it's rock or whatever, we use English.
Yeah.
It's gone.
Yeah.
So Maltese has been kind of relegated to a kind of mummified type of music, which today we still call Anna.
Yeah.
And it's a very static type of honor, because when I attend the festivals, you know, the festival I like going, etc., it seems to me like there isn't that much happening. It's kind of the same thing. It hasn't moved on.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, it's interesting what you say about language, because as you can see from these records, the 160 records which were produced in almost 2 years, not even 2 years, a year and a half, for a population of 240,000 under the British at that time, but I think it's quite evident the unquestionable sense of identity. Identity was not even a word going around like it is today, because there was no question about seeing Maltese. This was the language. You know, even though clearly there were people who had accepted English and so on and so forth, and you can see there's a strong Latinization as well, because we had the operatic and lyrical influence. But even if you had an imported style of music, yes, it was something Maltese. There wasn't even a question why it shouldn't, even though they would imitate Italian songs and films from the Talkies and all of this. It's a strong identity statement. I think that this is why it's interesting for us today, because there's always questions about identity today. What is it, what is not, and how I should not feel this, and where is there? It's just not even a question. Another thing I'd like to say is, for me that came to mind, is that, for example, when you heard the Carnival tune, when I first heard that track, it sounded to me like something coming out of New York in 1930s. It sounded very cosmopolitan, very, you know, city. And then I said, hey, the Carnival Punch, it could have been in New York, but it must be through the influence of music that he was listening to, either from the Talkies or the records. It's not like today, that's just like you download music and have access to what's going on in the rest of the world. They didn't have this. So, how did he develop such a style? That's also interesting, even though, and how was it importing tangos, this, that, and the other, you know? It was through the records they were hearing, but they had heard up at the point in time, and the movies. No other way he could have. I don't think I'm a part from what I saw was actually traveling the world looking at music. He was based here. So what are his influences as well? This is also an interesting point.
Can I ask a second question? How was music consumed, international music? Was there, was Radio Fusion around then?
Radio Fusion was started in 1935, as far as I remember well. It was cable radio, it was a cable-wide radio. It was set up to counteract Italian fascist propaganda. It was set up by the English in 1935, and then went on post-war. What's interesting about Radio Fusion is that these records, again, it's an interesting point, even though the production was smaller and was only for such a short time, the memory and the song of these records went on far beyond those years. Way off the interwar period, were heard right through the war. People tell me that they were played regularly through the war and even after the persecution. So much so that some of the most popular ones, this is interesting, the most popular ones were re-recorded on the 45s in the 60s. Now, at least that secured the memory of the records, because if that hadn't happened, my father's generation, for example, remember Chiria, they remember some Maddalena, they don't remember the 1930s records, they remember the 1960s records. But that at least secured the memory to go on for another couple of generations. Now, consumption of music by that time, yes, 50s, 60s, had changed considerably. 50s, you get vinyl, you get tape.
So in the 1930s, like, 1930s,
it was gramophones, and probably early beginnings of radio, but I don't think.
So it was a very limited audience. Because gramophones obviously were very inaccessible to most people, they were expensive.
Yeah, but you go to places like Cairo, gramophones were used in public areas. People would go to cafes, big cafes, and they'd have gramophones playing on cartoon, for example. And they were also used in public places and spaces. This was the way of consuming music. It was a shadow. quite a heavy, breakable, brittle substance. But they were producing even better quality shirts in the 50s.
Interesting that they were played in public, very much in public. Yeah. Almost like the previous sensor of a disco.
Of the?
Of a disco, almost. Huh? Right, that they were played in public places and people would gather there and listen.
The variety of music actually doesn't quite appear surprising.
Which
the variety of music recorded by these artists, because for instance, I'm familiar, quite familiar with what was recorded in the same period and just before in the in Buenos Aires, for instance, and the Victor Enhouse Orchestra, although it was set up mainly to record tangos, recorded all sorts of music from ruler music such as rancheras, such as the Argentinian samba, the chacareras, etc., to string music, to jazz music, so with the same orchestra, same musicians. So I think it was more of a commercial decision.
Yeah, technological and
yes,
what
exactly.
The studio could take.
Exactly. But my question is actually to tie into what's being said, the influences. Has any effort been made to looking at what type of music was being imported before this period? There was any correlation?
Not necessarily. However, I can tell you that in my looking for records, I was coming across everything. And along with the Monty 78s, you have boxes and boxes. Because these things, you go, one of the best sources was actually families, right? Families and ex-record shops or closing down record shops like Carabot. I was lucky enough to catch Carabot in these closing down years where I'd go again and again and look and find record players and this and records. You had one room with shelving stacked with 78s, so they didn't know what to do with them. They eventually just got skips and chucked a whole lot along with. Now you look at Carabot today, it's called Bamboo or something like that, and sells children's clothes. So every piece of memory that possibly was erased now. But then, I would, obviously, you can tell through the records that there are there what kind of records were popular, depending on how many boxes there were. What people, therefore, we got the mainly classical stuff, operas, a lot of symphonic stuff, because these are all 78s from that era. And yes, you can tell more or less. It was actually easier to find stacks and stacks of just general international titles, classical and lyrical and operatic, rather than all these records. Then there were families that had, because they inherited from their grandfather, along with the grandfather, now we've got stacks of records, we never listen to these things. So you would find them amongst boxes of international titles. It was always bigger, clearly, the number of international titles than the local ones.
Another quick question. Do you know anything, what happened to the masters of these recordings? Were they lost?
The EMI masters are still in the warehouse. I was at the EMI archive trust fund in Hayes. The record industry today is in a mess, as you know. So the EMI archive trust fund and the which is the same company as Abbey Road Studios. Actually, a couple of these were transferred to Abbey Road Studios because I would approach the legal part of EMI, and then they would give me the rights to whatever use it. They would do the transferring at Abbey Road, and then to me, so it was going back to the mother company. Interesting enough. But as you know, Abbey Road was on the market until they was exited last year. There was an effort, a national effort. So Abbey Road was about to be sold. Why? Because the record industry is down. They don't even have the money to sustain what's going on now, let alone 50, 60, 70 years of archives, which they have. And I know everything lies in there. Everything. Or it could. The thing is, the Maltese ones are there. there's all the masters they showed me. The Maltese masters is one they showed me copies, like make some vision. Having said that, I have even come across records here which were packed in boxes and never opened, and they were brand new, never been played, 8 years old. But they do have the thing. It's just that they don't have the money to man the archives, they don't have the money for people to chase around and look for your records. So you have to pay astronomical prices if you ask for something because you can't afford these things anymore.
This is wonderful work you've been doing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Since you are also a practical musician, I'd be curious to know your attitude towards one of the fundamental questions that remained with us ever since sound recordings became possible. You see, what you've been doing falls into an area of ethnomusicology which is important and has a long tradition. We call it salvage ethnomusicology. Ever since sound recordings came into existence, archives were created in Vienna, in Berlin, and in many other places. But producing, making sound recordings, preserving memory and some musical traditions has always been seen as problematic. From the very beginning, I explain myself. The first time composer Edward Elgar saw a gramophone, he said, good grief, the very thought of how much time of music is going to be recorded and preserved forever makes me cringe. Now, I suppose if you put that idea into more sophisticated terms, that means that preserving sounds, preserving the memory, alters the tradition. A tradition is made not only of memory, but also of forgetfulness. We need to forget some things in order to create new ones. And once the document exists, inevitably, it feeds back into the living tradition. There is a dynamic sort of conflict and a maintenance of balance in which practical musicians usually enter, finding their formula, their personal solution. And so I don't know the Maltese situation too well, so I don't know how much this good amount of documentation you're making available is going to influence contemporary practice. But I would be curious to know how you feel about that and how much you would like it to be influential on contemporary practice.
This work. Well, look. Before this came out, I clearly, because I'm passionate about it, and I'm not a collector. People would tell me, what's your interest? I said, look, I'm not a collector. I'm not really interested in collecting records. I mean, I find them interesting, and they're really interesting artifacts, but they should be in museums because they can be preserved. I'm interested in the music, primarily. Along with the music, clearly I was interested in the stories that came along with the music. And definitely the music is complemented by the stories, and the stories are complemented by music. It's the whole experience, actually, even this idea of the records is selling, in a sense, the experience of this true music and stories. So listening to this thing, I would like spend weeks transferring, and I'd come across a record and go like, wow, you know, I'd hear Cement Sound, the track you heard earlier on. It's like, I've never heard anything like this. And it resonates very strongly, I think, with us. We never heard anything like it, but it definitely homes in somewhere. His quality, the cadence, it's a part of us somehow. It's very Mediterranean, at the same time, very regional. So we can really identify with it. So at first, I thought, yeah, this music is going to cause a sensation because. Come on, 8 years later, you know, it's like music coming back, and it will definitely have an impact on the folk singers and the folk musicians. They never even heard this, you know? And genuinely creating, genuinely entertaining music. It was music for entertainment. It was funny, it was entertaining, it was naive at times, it was funny enough, it was genuine, there's a sense of genuine entertainment. You could laugh at this, you know, as well, the funny stuff. So I said, yeah, this is no good. Look at your original, we're just doing songs in English with these guys. So I thought that it would have a bigger impact in terms of on music and musicians, especially within the field of the Arna singers. Until it was released, and I realized that these folk singers actually it's part of a we call them dilettanti motives. It's not a very nice thing, but it's more of a hobby kind of thing. Just like you go trapping birds, and nothing against whatever, but you go trapping birds, you go to see Anna on a Sunday morning, you go whatever, it's more of a community kind of thing. And because it lost so much of its social function, the context, many of the social contexts for Anna were lost, it just exists within a few particular contexts, and they're not even sure what they should be doing with it artistically. And I don't think it's even a concern of theirs, because it's more of a dilettante kind of thing. So, in actual fact, I realized that they're not even really interested in, they know the names of these people because they've heard about them, and some of them have a few recordings, and they talk about them as like, some of them do revere them in a certain way, but in a, either about their ability to rhyme, fine, but not about artistic quality or musical quality. And I realized that actually they're not even interested in listening to them. And I gave copies to a lot of these people, folk, musicians at the Bocce Club where they do it every Sunday. And I asked them, I said, like, a few days ago I was there, doing some more stuff. And I said, you know, it's like, so what's the reaction? It's like, do these guys, he said, no, they don't really care, actually, they have to do what they do. So, that's true. And this is why it exists in this modified form that you're talking about, because I think they've lost touch of it with this lineage that was happening, you know? But they can't, this is evident to me because the quality of guitar playing and singing tends to be much better there. And it's, I have friends who said, you know, I was listening to this stuff, it sounds just like flamenco in the 20s, 30s, it was very, very similar. But then it evolved to a certain level. Now it's interesting for me to hear this because I believe that there are rudiments of something that can develop. If you go back to a source like this and see what, you know, through this is probably the earliest stuff, and then there's recording in the 40s, 50s, PBS radio, and even here, there's a development of stuff, and the lineage of guitarists, and the lineage of singers, and the singers in the 50s and 60s were recording on PBS and saying, hey, we recorded this stuff back in the 30s, when we went to Miami Tunis, and this is what we sang, this is what we did. So it's even referenced in the later years to the 1931 recording. So it had quite an impact, you know. But in terms of musical development, I have yet to see that. I'd like to. Because again, like you're saying, it inspires me on a musical, from a musical point of view as well, what can I do with it? So I've always been at these things.
Well, we can learn a lesson also from the word lost. Why were they lost? Most probably, as always, and there's no right management. Right management of the situation. Why only 2 years, 1931 and 1932? Were the worst years economically, more?
They weren't.
They were. In Italy, they weren't money there. In Italy, there was also a great influx of culture. Then the question is always, why? Only 2 years. Then, that's all. Money? Well, I don't think so. It's a matter of management, maybe.
Possibly, and I'd love to already exists to be 100 of taxons, already exists also the size of the culture, you know? You have to help people's audience. I don't know, after 240,000, how big was the audience? Interestingly enough, the amount of post packaging these records to the Maltese immigrants in Australia and Canada, and they were packaging stuff for them and saying, hey, you know, all your records here, send them to your relatives and so on and so forth. So those are a bit of an extended audience. There was the audience that was buying records in Tunis, the Maltese that were buying records in Tunis. I know this because the records are still around in Tunis, and they refer to the shop in Babylon, who closed down in the 60s. Once the shop closed down in the 1960s, most collectors and individuals bought up the stock, and it's still in a few people's hands. But he was selling to the Maltese, and they were getting records. Okay, there's 20,000, I don't know how much you sold, how many you sold. But how big the market was, as yet, I don't know how many records were sold, I don't know how many grandmas were sold, I don't know. Why it was stopped? I do hear of stories, now that the stories are coming up and say, hey, by the way, I remember Giuseppe Prato going into Carabao every day to check on the records. This was until the 60s, you know, and he used to be there, and I remember this guy had this problem with his mouth and his speech and so on, and he was there every day asking if anything was sold. And then I hear another story about Semenza actually being, he was actually quite pissed off because he didn't get his dues as a musician, he wasn't going to get what he wanted, was promised, you know. So this still happens in the recording industry, small as well. Yeah, I mean, there's no explanation as yet.
And the politics and the pickup of music production are always there everywhere in the world.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I agree with you about. I want to. Let me put it to you, so I'd like to try more to present this music to various London groups and see how they react. Maybe you have, but I wonder if you might get more positive response.
I'm saying
more people, you know?
No, what I'm saying is that this stuff has been kind of given to them and say, hey, this is but at least the ones I come in touch with, it I think there would be more interest from the younger ones, for example, to get access to this material and to make something out of it, because they're more, you know, aspiring guitarists or whatever. I think they're more likely to. I felt that a few people I approached for the kind of threatened my fact that there was this stuff and preferred not to listen to it and just do what they do. I don't rule out the possibility that there is, could be interest, and I think I will be the first one to be in there if there's a possibility of even developing stuff hands-on, on a hands-on way, you know, developing artistic research with the stuff that there is, content, and using this as a reference. It's available, like, available to whoever really.
I'd just like to return briefly to the theme or question which I opened up after your talk. As I said then, I was struck by the blending of styles which both the musicians and the orchestra seemed to be achieving. And you mentioned it in answering Noel's question, that there was the weaving in of Italianic song patterns and rhythmic patterns in the voices. There were grace notes there which were associated more with operetta. In a way, this I would think would turn out to be inspiring for young musicians today. I'll give you an example. When you opened up Etnica and you presented that wonderful CD and you developed that theme, you were using a kind of band approach. You were trying, in a sense, to reproduce. memories of that. You were weaving together all these folk music, children's songs, lullabies with a theme which you yourself developed. You were trying, of course, to weave in other Mediterranean influences like flamenco. So what I think I see is that in this very early music, that great, to say, the quality is indeed high of these singers and musicians. But they were blending too, and you were blending. Maybe we've been through a period in which Anna has separated itself off.
Yeah.
And what we should be seeing, partly through the circulation of these old discs, is that in the past, in the 1930s, Anna musicians had no compunction to mix with other styles. It didn't have to be a purist thing at all.
Definitely, that's one of the things about music that there's no, can you be a purist about it? You know, it's like arts develops a positive era, develops in reaction to one another, and it takes on. You know, folk music actually is this thing that it takes on from the contemporary society and blends with it, and it's passed on within the tradition, and it grows in an organic way. So I don't think that, I think this is how it should exist today. You know, that it should develop in an organic way, but not in a forced, superimposed style and just mixed up with Anna. You know, this is something where we have. We talk about Epica, we have to be careful about it. It's like, hang on a minute, it's like, does it remain the tradition, or is it like, or we just do it out of artistic license to say, yeah, I can do this, because I do this. Regarding, again, you're coming in on the idea of the styles existing side by side, I think, yes, but it depended on which strata of society was listening to the music again, no? Because there was probably already a strain of the folk culture by some even middle upper class, as you can see on the papers already, and they didn't necessarily associate with that. As a fact, the people they don't associate with folk culture. To be honest with you, there's one record where Wati Capia and Tommy Castelletti they mimic a comic entertainers, they mimic an Anna song, and they make fun of it, actually, even them. And that's interesting. I was a bit disappointed myself, but it's like, oh, come on, you know? But they were really taking the piss out of the Anna thing, and doing it in a lyrical, operatic kind of way, and so it says that the records say a lot more, you know, than just the music.
So I was two questions actually. One, whether there is any political content at all, or whether politics was deliberately avoided. I mean, I know this was mostly entertaining music, so I'm not sure politics would have a role in the sort of music. But I was just wondering whether there were any political references in these recordings. And secondly, whether there is any more information, or whether we could elaborate on how this music fits in the political tensions of the time, particularly the British-Italian tensions. I saw one of the caricatures where these recordings seem to be a weapon against the Gergo Italiano band. And it proposes these recordings as a natural progression from when Maltese started being used in the law courts. So I was wondering if you could
I think this is the most beautiful thing I found in records, the very correctness of the records. More than political, it's a social political kind of climate, which is immediately used of language, Maltese language, which was the end of the statement. Probably statement. Was it done deliberately? Was there a political motive behind it? I don't know. political caricature from the Muslims for reference accounting records. And then there was also the Disco de Marti, which, however, refers to how everybody forgot about politics and everything and just got the money from the grants and went to buy the records and people not spending the money on records and how it affected them. So it's just that the political thing on Ukraine is not there. But other than that, and the reference to musicians and there are two of them, Disco de Marti and Disco de Marti, they were quatrains which were written in the newspapers. However, the newspapers themselves were pretty populist, you know, the Jamaica, papers, they weren't conservative. They were more on the left. Papers and clearly it was I think a popular expression in this sense of popular.
If I can add something from this, one writes one might possibly find references in a negative sense to this Maltese music in the proletarian press. In the Malta, for instance, sort of being seen as yet another attempt at ousting Italians, sort of using Maltese as an excuse to introduce the English and to oust Italian. I mean, I've no idea. I mean, I've seen some Malta, but not in this mind, obviously. But possibly there might be something in the proletarian press against this sort of thing going on.
Well, look, I hope that people will take on this critique in terms of at least study on a certain academic level, because, my there's so many aspects that you can see, there's social, there's political, there's musicological, there's this, you know, there's the memory of things, consumption of music, there's so many aspects of the whole thing, it just brings up so many sides that clearly it's fascinating, but you can only focus on one or two, basically, you know. There was one student who actually did his MA on the Marchetti, the storytelling, and he used these as a reference, and I hope that this material is used more as a reference, and that's why it should be made accessible at university, for example, for listening at university. Because well, at least the material is there now, and there's a reference to it. You know, this is something that it refers to this kind of the music, the Maltese department, the history department. There's so much, there's so many angles, and I don't think that's up to me to go into the political implications of the caricature of Gerarda, but there's a whole story of Gerarda, just Gerarda's caricatures. Stacks of material in the newspaper is just amazing. So my interest is actually making it accessible. This was the book. This was the first idea. The idea is to I always traveled so many places and go to a record shop and I found the music from the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, every country has there. So I said, let's start to create a line of products. I don't think it should either just exist in databases and national archives. It should be accessible off the shelf, you know, just like everything up. Make it attractive so that people would go for it. This is very unique. So I saw this idea of Field for Records and the Lost Boys, because this is the first. Next week there's a double CD of this coming out. Again, designs in the style of the old newspapers.
When is that?
That's out next week.
Next week?
Yeah.
But is it going to be a launch?
There'll probably be something that will form you at the Mata Record Shop. The Mata Record Shop, for one, benefited for the whole team because even they have forgotten what happened. Because it was their father's father. And they have forgotten it. And so I said, look, this is. So now, there's a story for the place. This is why they should be signed up there. So I might do a launch there, like when I launched the book. The first time. And in July, there's a scheduled is the complete works of Emmanuel Chiga, the violin singer, who played this song earlier. It is a double CD and a 12-inch vinyl compilation. And with the vinyl compilation is then a digital download card, so I'm connecting digital with physical CD products and vinyl. And this is another interesting aspect, you know, it's like how are we consuming this same 19 vintage music today? What do you want to hear? How are you going to, you know, you can get a download today. And if you restore it or whatever, you put it back on fine. It's, things have changed, and also people have seen the tangible product now. I mean, this is a bit over tangible. It's like heavy. But it's amazing. But there's the interest of now releasing vinyl, because people are asking for it. So vinyl, CD, and download distribution. And then towards the end of the year, they're releasing a collection of Marchetti and Brian Lantz stories. So we're selling probably just CD and digital download, and keeping at least a constant release of interesting items, you know, collected items, clearly. It's not mass. It's not going to be the masses, because it's not just about, and it's not even just about selling music, it's about selling my experience, you know, physically, and the stories, and the era kind of thing, and this, the experience of the time. So this at least being a niche thing allows me to really work on design and certain factors, which, you know, how I like to do it. So that's it.
Andy, thank you very, very much. Obviously, you've done very meticulous research, but you're obviously at the start of something.
Very big,
and that will go very deep. I hope from tonight, various kinds of collaboration open up between you and other researchers. It's both the history of a particular segment of the recent, well, almost recent past, and it's also following on another set of questions asked by the audience. It's all part of an ongoing, evolving, and changing live musical tradition.
Yeah.
And you can look at it from either way and from many other ways as well. So I had the feeling listening to you that you've injected into Maltese music a new dimension by not just doing the research, but by recording the research, and then by, as you're going to do the summer, marketing the research. I think these are all very interesting aspects of research which can be there and should be there. And so slowly, one expects to see various feedbacks and combinations emerging. And I wish you would please let us know before these events in the summer and in the autumn, so we can advertise them through the work in progress mailing list and also through the university.